In January of this year, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton outlined the United States' views on freedom and the World Wide Web, encouraging governments of the world to protect open access to an unfiltered internet for their citizens. Secretary Clinton called internet-enabled information networks the new nervous system for our planet, and celebrated their ability to help lower the barriers between people and government and to quickly respond to crises.
When something happens in Haiti or Hunan, the rest of us learn about it in real time from real people, and we can respond in real time as well. There are more ways to spread more ideas to more people than at any moment in history. And even in authoritarian countries, information networks are helping people discover new facts and making governments more accountable.
The speech marked a dramatic new policy posture. There isn't yet a global understanding of what a free and open internet means. And even in the United States, where freedom of speech and of the press are among our most sacred values, we are in a constant debate over how these values carry over onto the net, and figuring out just how we balance these values against some of the perils that have come with a free and open net. Issues of anonymity, child endangerment, and copyright violation, just to name a few. At the same time, the United States has never been in a better position to push politically for a conversation about these issues. The 2008 presidential race engaged citizens in dialogue in a way that never would have been possible without the net. And following the election, many saw the opportunity to pull the open communication strategies seen during the campaign into the actual process of policymaking. Today's guest is one of the experts behind Barack Obama's multimedia strategy. Michael Slaby was the Chief Technology Officer of Obama for America and helped plan the technology strategy for the president's transition team. David Weinberger sat down with Michael to talk about the strategy of using the web to engage citizens in the often mundane work of policymaking. But first, they talked a little bit about Secretary Clinton's initiatives for internet freedom.
The internet freedom talk that Secretary Clinton gave was incredibly important that it happened. I think it was incredibly important that it was given the prominence that it was given by a cabinet secretary. There were limits to how far they or she or it was willing to go when it comes to taking sides in the internet freedom debate. There's a danger in suggesting that internet freedom equals free societies. This is not inexorably true that more access to the internet will inexorably lead to democratic institutions and liberal democracies in other countries where there are currently authoritarian regimes. There's not a cause and effect relationship necessarily between access and those other foreign policy outcomes that we as a nation still deem important, democratization being the one I'm talking about. The problems with the speech lay in an unwillingness to be partisan about the process. That as in the U.S., we are in favor of certain kinds of censorship, like child pornography. It is not that all censorship needs to go away. It's that the individual autonomy of a person and individual power needs to be respected. An individual's right to their own opinions and ideas needs to be respected. Free press. These are social values that we take for granted in the U.S. that don't exist in some of these other places where internet freedom is questionable or suspect or completely foreign concept in some places. And there's a huge, the other thing is there's a gigantic spectrum of restricted freedom to the internet and what that looks like. It varies widely from country to country. There are technical limitations on internet access, like the Great Firewall of China. The Great Firewall is what it's often joked as. That is a technical filter on internet content. There are also self-censoring. The social values around self-censoring, where people have been indoctrinated in such a way into a culture that they refuse to participate, which is not the same clearly as an internet filter, but can be just as damaging to the marketplace of ideas and to the concept of free press and to the concept of dissent, which I think if you look at what the speech hints at, it's moving toward the social infrastructures that make liberal democracy possible in the United States, things like the free press, things like individual dissent, things like those kinds of rights that we tend to take for granted and assume are under the surface under an authoritarian regime, but aren't necessarily so. And I think we need to be more explicit in what we value and what we are valuing if we're gonna really help this problem. It's going to be a fight, and it is a partisan situation where we have to have an opinion, and it has to be predicated on values that we're willing to stand behind. And I think she wasn't quite willing, and maybe the time wasn't right. Maybe you'd make one speech and then you make another one, but I think at some point lines have to be drawn in this kind of a debate. It is not a nonpartisan situation.
So in one sense, it was a highly partisan speech, as
highly political.
Well, and partisan in favor of the internet, which is one of the reasons internet people like you and me said, "Oh, it's great that the Secretary of State did that."
The internet utopians were going crazy. There were some good comments about that.
So, in some sense, it was partisan, but it can put us in the position of saying, "Well, we're in favor of internet freedom," and going to another country and them saying, "Well, sure, okay, then how about allowing all that child porn? And if you don't want to allow child porn on yours, who are you to say that we should not allow normal naked porn of adults on ours because we are a faith-based government?" So what you're suggesting is that the policy should have been more specific about the types of
freedoms that we're talking about.
Where it's freedom to dissent, it's freedom of press more or less moved to individuals and on the internet. It's that level
freedom of expression. These are the kinds of things that I think were not explicitly stated and need to be. Because in the end, what she's really talking about, I believe, what the Secretary is really addressing is, we're in favor of our form of internet freedom. The Chinese would say that they have internet freedom. They're protecting their society the same way we say we're protecting our society from child pornography. They say they're protecting their society from dissent. There's a different set of, this is a values question. And this is a fight over the values of expression and freedom and dissent in society. And we have to game up for that fight.
Although it's certainly not an easy
distinction. No, it's incredibly hard.
Right? Because what looks like suppression of dissent from outside a culture can look like protection of values, of core values.
Absolutely. And I think that it is extremely challenging to promote your own values and be respectful of others at the same time.
Interestingly, I thought in her speech, she a couple of times referred to the need to what the speech said, as I understood it, was remove anonymity. And this was coupled with protection of a different sort of, well, we'll call it censorship, I guess we might call it a filtering, so that we can't put copyrighted materials on the internet. It was sort of the West's obsession with what doesn't get posted. Mm-hmm. And that seemed to at least some of us, or to me, as a jarring note to hear anonymity raised as something that we need to be gotten rid of, since it's anonymity that protects a lot of political dissent.
But this is one of the questions that she at least raised. I don't think, no, if she went far enough, or she certainly wasn't prepared for the Q&A about this question. But anonymity is a serious question on the internet. There are, like you say, there are certain types of anonymity that are virtually required for safety. But there are also a lot of problems online that would be solved by doing away with anonymity. It is not a black and white question. Very few of these questions are, obviously. And anonymity is just like censorship. There is some gray. In a non-anonymous internet, child pornography would be a self-selecting problem for the most part, right? If people had to identify themselves as the consumers of this, in most societies, these people would be shamed out of their behavior very, very quickly, right? But at the same time, in an authoritarian regime where political dissent results in, you know, indefinite detention, anonymity becomes a requirement for participation. The other challenge with a lot of this stuff is that while it's not particularly technical, it's very detail-oriented. The distinctions are very fine-grained, you know, being able to speak in generalities about internet freedom is really, really hard because the subject just resists.
Her very first question, the first question posed to her was, and I will roughly paraphrase, from, you know, because this is what I remember anyway of it, was exactly about anonymity, and you've said that anonymity is basically a bad thing, and yet we need it for dissent. What do you do? This seems to be, and her answer was, you have to strike a balance. Mm-hmm. And I guess The question is how you, in technical terms, how you strike a balance so that we have anonymity if you're talking about dissent within your authoritarian country, but you do not if you are making salacious remarks about, you know, underage.
You're posting copyrighted material.
Exactly. So it's the strike of balance sounded good. It's hard to know how that would be implemented.
Yes, and this is where the rubber hits the road between the difference between campaigning and governing. Campaigning is typically almost exclusively done in generalities. Governing is the process of implementation. And so it is both less interesting on a certain level and much more difficult to talk about the implementation of some kind of balanced anonymity than it is to say balanced anonymity is what we need to strive for.
So is it less interesting or more divisive? Because everybody's in favor of some large campaign goal, whatever it is.
I think it is.
But when you go to implement it, people have to decide if they're going to fund it this way or that.
I think it depends on the audience. I think for a large audience, it's less interesting. For a small, concerned audience, it's more divisive and more interesting once you get to the where the rubber actually hits the road about, you know, people like us who spend our lives talking and thinking about the internet and technology and the relationship between that and policy and politics and all these other things. This is the part that is most interesting, right? The generalities are least interesting. But for the general public, you know, the general public is probably bored at this by this point in the radio broadcast. They fell asleep a long time ago, right? This is just too detailed. It's not their interest, right? But the idea of supporting democratic values abroad, people can get behind that, right? That is a soundbite that is accessible and consumable by a general audience. Translating that into action is hard, right? And this is the role of the people who now take on the challenge of what we did on the campaign from a new media perspective and translating the same passion and intensity from a values-driven, big-picture campaign to a policy-driven, issue-oriented governance process. That's a very hard translation, and it's actually the lack of overarching value set and an agenda makes it more difficult for the guys in the White House right now to be executing on the media as well as they might be able to otherwise.
So, well, let's take a concrete case. We've just been through a year of pretty intense debate about healthcare reform. Looking back, what might we have done in order to use either the tools or the approaches that the Obama campaign used to build a social movement, an engaged public, in order to move the healthcare debate forward?
Possibly the most effective thing to have helped the healthcare problem was to be able to do other things at the same time. It is a endemic problem of progressive organizations that they become single-issue entities. And OFA acting as a single-issue entity around healthcare.
Obama for America.
Obama for America, now Organizing for America at the DNC. Acting as a single-issue entity on healthcare falls into a similar trap. The campaign was a vehicle for everyone's in passion and everyone's desire to see change in all of their areas. Government is big. Healthcare is not the only thing going on. There are massive issues. We spent the whole first 10 minutes of this talking about internet freedom abroad and U.S. foreign policy. There's two wars going on. There's a lot of there's an economy problem, I heard. I think there's this banking thing. There are other issues. And the inability to focus on a goal and still allow people to continue to engage on the things that they are most passionate about diminishes both. It turns people off to trying to engage in the process. And by forcing your priority onto a community, it diminishes their interest in it.
Is this the difference between the top-down and bottom-up? The top-downs tend to over-focus, and the bottom-up, the people who are actually engaged in this will naturally see healthcare as one issue among many, but also be interested in a more bottom-up approach?
I think you need to do both. I mean, I think what I'm advocating is that you have to be able to do both. You need to be able to have your own priorities and have your own voice. And healthcare was an important one, and there was an opportunity to pass it, and it was important to be done, and it was done. That it was hard and long and complicated does not diminish the fact that it was significant. The issue for me is that you need to be able to have your own priorities whilst continuing to support the fact that other people have other priorities. That your supporters, the millions of people that helped drive the energy of the campaign and that are still eager to sort of spend themselves in a worthy cause, to quote Teddy Roosevelt, are still they're just not all willing to die on healthcare. That's not the hill that they'd all choose to fight on, right? So letting them, you have a choice. You can either let them choose their battle or you can lose them. I think we have trumped ourselves back into a little bit of being so single-issued around healthcare makes us less effective on healthcare because we are less passionate as a group, because we're fighting ourselves to sort of be too focused on one thing.
And so this is a way that we can learn from, in which the organization and technology that worked for a campaign didn't work so well for governing. But I want to point to raise another possibility in addition, which is when you're campaigning, you have a very clear goal. You're trying to get your person elected. When you're governing, you, because it's politics, you go through what can be a grinding process of giving up pieces in order to get what you want. It's you know, it's how you govern.
Compromise is part of the process.
And that can be, I assume, but I'm asking you, it can be harder to gather public enthusiasm for a long process in which you see the big goal that you're working for gets sort of narrowed down to what actually can be implemented. So does this mean that there's a gap between the tools that we use to organize for a campaign and the tools that we use for government, that there is not a seamless transition?
I don't know that it's a tool gap as much as it's a communications and education gap. It's easy to say we have an election day, we got to get out, we have to do these things, we need to make sure, you know, GOTV is a simple process, get out the vote, a simple process that any volunteer for a campaign understands. We got to get our people out on election day. Healthcare with, you know, the Senate, you know, everybody basically needing to turn themselves into the Senate parliamentarian to understand what's going on is harder to sort of stay fired up about over a long period of time. The nice thing about campaigns is they have all these actual deadlines, and deadlines are good for a sense of urgency. Sense of urgency is good for activation and mobilization. This is only a limitation in governing if you get away from talking about how healthcare is part of your agenda, your values as a whole, what your agenda is. If healthcare is its own issue that is somehow separate from everything else that you're doing and engaging in, it becomes much harder to maintain momentum when the Senate stalls. When the Senate stalls, you could talk about something else in the same vein, with the same values and the same things, and pivot to another issue that you can maintain momentum with, and then come back to healthcare when things move again in a more fluid way. If you can translate the values-driven stuff that we did on the campaign to a values-driven government process.
So if you're going from Obama for America, the campaign organization, to Organizing for America, which is the Democratic National Committee's, version of it, mm-hmm. Basically the same set of people and tools, mm-hmm. You would change the communication of values, make sure that that continues at a high level and with enthusiasm. What else would you change to go from campaigning to governing?
I don't want to get too far into second guessing Natalie and the team, the new media team, and the DNC, because I think they're doing a really good job.
You're still doing some work for the White House, is that?
Yeah, I still do some operational technology stuff for the White House.
Okay, so that was by way of disclosure.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. And I'm in contact with these people, and they're friends and colleagues, and we talk, and these are ideas that I've shared with them. I think that it is a big challenge to take on for someone like Natalie to come into the DNC and take on the new media with the expectations that were set during the campaign that are totally unrealistic for a non-campaign setting in certain regards. And I think they've done a really good job. They've added people to the community that are interested now that weren't engaged during the campaign. And so they're doing things well. I think that the limitation is being able to, from a communications standpoint, have a framework that allows them to walk and chew gum at the same time, that allows them to engage on multiple fronts, because, you know, it's much harder to sort of have a message of the day in campaign talk in a government where you don't necessarily control what's important on any given day, and there's just a lot more things to deal with. Government's big. Everyone's kind of, this is the lesson of the transition process, which is an insane project all of its own, to figure out the entire, you know, federal government in 77 days. It's a big government. There's a lot to do. There are a lot of problems to take care of. There are a lot of things to steward. There are a lot of programs. Being able to be a master of your entire domain is important. And I think it's really a communications challenge and not a tool set question that has been hard to, it's been a hard needle to thread for over the last year.
An unrelated question.
Sure.
The role of open source in government tech, and in campaign tech as well.
There are lots of good uses for open source technology in lots of different areas. You know, the whitehouse.gov is now on an open source content management platform called Drupal. It was a choice made for a lot of reasons, not the least of which was the ability to be more flexible about features and how we develop and being able to draw on and commit back to a large community of people developing on a project so that the platform can grow and expand in ways that a proprietary system is hard to be as flexible with. I think that's a great opportunity for using open source software. It's a well battle tested system that is very secure, has been, you know, any web enabled or any computer system is going to have technology or security questions. People will argue that open source is less secure and more secure. It is neither. It can be more secure or it can be less secure depending on the project, depending on the people working on the project, how big the project is, how many developers have their hands in the code and are finding bugs, which can be a benefit to large projects like Drupal where problems are caught and found quickly. There are probably more opportunities that have been realized in open source technology because the government procurement process is complicated and hard and expensive, and there is much less tolerance for making mistakes with innovation. One of the things about the campaign that makes innovation easy is that it's, you know, if you mess something up, as long as it's, you know, not truly critical, you just sort of roll with it and try something else the next day, and it's a lot more tolerant of error in certain areas. Government is not in a lot of places, and one of the things I think that is a struggle with government, and this is not just about open source, this is about innovation in general, and I think this is something that, you know, the guys like Vivek Kundra, the White House, the OMB CIO, and Anish Chopra and the OSTP CTO, God, there's a lot of acronyms going around.
Office of Science and Technology Policy.
Policy, crazy. Right. Run into all the time is that creating spaces where innovation is safe, because innovation is messy. Things work sometimes and sometimes they don't, and sometimes that is a process that gets, you know, it's like it's like cooking. Sometimes it's messy, and creating spaces where that's okay and protecting the things where that's not is an ongoing and important challenge for technology that is an organizational challenge that nobody sees happen and nobody sees progress, but is so important to be able to create spaces where innovation is possible and allowed and encouraged, but protect, you know, things, classified systems and secure things where innovation is not to be tolerated, not even wanted necessarily, depending on what you're talking about.
And there are some wonderful examples now of projects that, to my mind, would have been unthinkable just a few years ago because they are high risk, they're experimental, they may work, they may not. There's the OpenGov stuff, for example, that Beth Novick has been doing, and even the massive release of government data.
Data.gov.
Yes, is another way of getting information out quickly, may not be perfectly cleaned up and, it could take years and years to allow innovation to occur on top of and with that data.
It's really a question of perspective and sort of an operational posture that tolerates imperfection. Right? This is a system where we want to empower other people to mash up government data and surface it for other people in ways that we haven't even conceived of or they haven't even realized might be useful. And in order to do that, you have to have some tolerance that the data is not perfect if you're going to do this efficiently. And that requires trust on a number of levels with a number of different audiences that is that is laudable. It's worth that. That is a thing that is not easy to find.
Part of my reaction to Secretary Clinton's talk was, much as I loved hearing this coming from a Secretary of State, was, you know, sort of easy for us to say, because we're saying the freedoms that we have, you ought to have too, and it doesn't require us to make any changes
to do anything.
It doesn't cost us anything to make this. Are there types of internet freedom that we either don't have or don't have sufficiently that we should be advocating more for ourselves as a sort of a way of modeling that, yeah, we're willing to make a change too?
If you're talking about access questions, we have significantly worse broadband penetration than a lot of other countries in the world. If you talk about true access to the internet being unfettered ability to consume information and video in all of the ways that are possible, that's pretty hard on a slow connection these days. The internet has become a multi-headed, multimedia space that doesn't require broadband to participate, but for a lot of intents and purposes, it's required to fully engage in the internet. So if we take the assumption that broadband is a requirement for access, we have a lot of problems to solve. I think that's an area where we fall way behind a lot of other countries. And, you know, the concept of internet and technology infrastructure in this country is often talked about but not seen as a major priority, but should be. This could certainly be couched in our own fight for our own internet freedom. Which I think would help make this less of a "you need what we have" problem and more of a more universal human need for better information, right? For better access, for more clarity and more openness in communications across all cultures, including ours, rather than "your culture needs to have our culture's values," which is a much tougher sell.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Michael Slaby was the Chief Technology Officer for Obama for America. He is now the Chief Technology Strategist for Tomorrow Ventures. You can find out more about Michael and even catch a talk he recently gave to the Berkman Center at our blog, blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. This episode of Radio Berkman was produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, with David Weinberger at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts.